widespread everywhere across the country but Hawaii. That was the report from the Centers for Disease Control this month on the severity of the flu season, with an increasing number of deaths among the very old and the very young. The number of influenza cases is growing in the islands, but because the season hasn't peaked yet, healthcare officials want to blunt the spread of the flu. This week, the association launches an intense flu prevention program. This morning, we sat down with Hilton Rathel, the head of the Hawaii Healthcare Association, who says, "We can't let our guard down.
We really want to focus on prevention. We want to stop Hawaii from having the same issues that they're having on the mainland. This has been a worse-than-usual flu season on the mainland, and it is peaking. They believe it's peaking right about now. And Hawaii tends to be about a month or 6 weeks behind the mainland in terms of its peak. So we want to focus on making sure that we keep people healthy, we keep them using best practices, and so that they don't get sick. And we want to avoid, if at all possible, some of the issues that are occurring on the mainland.
Tell us about that. How extreme has it been in some of these facilities?
Well, people have seen on the news some of the situations that are going on. There is a, there's a 12-year-old, I believe, that, a healthy 12-year-old who died within 2 days on the mainland of getting the flu. There are hospitals over there that, some hospitals that have set up tents in their emergency clinics, in their parking lots to handle the overflow in the emergency rooms. There are some hospitals that have had to cancel elective surgeries so that they could have space in their facilities for people with the flu, and there are other hospitals that have had to take over areas adjacent to their emergency rooms so that they can increase their capacity. So it in various, it's, and that's not all across the mainland, but there are areas in the mainland that have had to take some fairly significant measures to accommodate the severity and the volume of patients are getting with the flu this season.
We've heard in some of the headlines about the pediatric deaths that are up. Elderly also affected very severely. What are we doing to target those areas?
Well, the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, which represents all the acute care hospitals, long-term care facilities, home health agencies, hospices, assisted living facilities, and other providers in the state, we are working very closely in conjunction with a lot of community partners, and that includes the Department of Health, it includes AARP, it includes the payers like HMSA, Kaiser, and other payers, and it includes our hospitals as well. So we're working on a concerted campaign to get the message out there, to focus on prevention, to focus on best practices. If you do get sick, stay away from people, stay home. So we, again, are working very hard to see what we can do to mitigate the impact of the flu here in Hawaii.
Now, I just got a robocall, a warning from my provider saying, hey, you didn't get your flu shot, come on in, just stop on by. And I did get my flu shot, but then when I called the company, they said, well, maybe somebody in your family hasn't got the vaccine this season, and they're encouraging us to, you know, get your husband, get your kids in there, just to make sure they're protected. So I guess you've got different companies that are doing different things to try and get the word out this season.
Yes, as I just said, everyone is concerned about this. This is a real burden it's a burden on workers, on employers, if people get sick. There are some companies that have had 10 or 20% of their workforce that has gotten sick. There are some schools that have shut down entire classrooms at a time and then gone through and sanitized all their, had to go through and wipe down all the desks and the chairs and things like that and go through all the bathrooms. So we want to ensure that that there's a lot of messaging out there. Now, people, if you're going to change behavior, if people, for example, are not used to getting a flu shot, well, then sometimes, it may take 3, 4, 5 different messages before they actually listen to it, before they actually act on it. So the fact that someone like Kaiser, in your example, has sent out a message is a very good thing, but sometimes that's not enough. Sometimes there's, people need to hear things 3, 4, 5 times. So that's why, again, we're working with all these different agencies, and there's multiple types of messaging that's going out there. We, for example, are working, this is one example of what we're doing. We're working on an op-ed for the Star Advertiser. We are working on a social media campaign using Twitter and other social media. And we're working on some other messaging as well, so that we are getting this message out, we and our partners are getting this message out in as many different ways as possible over the next few weeks.
Right, and you mentioned that sometimes you have to hear it several times. You know, what I hear from my family is, oh, when I got the vaccine, I got sick last time, so I don't want to go in there. But maybe it's a coworker or another friend that repeating that same message, and then they'll be more open to the idea of going in and getting vaccinated.
Well, that is true. And going back to your point about, you know, if someone does, you know, someone says, well, look, I got the flu shot and I didn't get, and I still got the flu. There are different strains of the vaccine out there, and there's no one vaccine that covers all the different strains that are out there. But the overwhelming consensus from healthcare professionals is that getting a flu shot is better than not getting a flu shot. So if and even if you do get the flu after you've had a flu shot, the flu shot may help the impact or the severity of the flu be not as bad as what it was if you hadn't got the flu shot. So we are recommending, and the general consensus is from healthcare professionals across the nation, that getting a flu shot is better than not getting a flu shot.
Right. And then some places of work will organize clinics where they'll have the providers come in, you know, in the lunchroom or a conference room, and then get their employees to, you know, go down there and just get vaccinated, try and make it easy for everybody just to get protected.
Yes, they are. There's lots of different places you can get a vaccine. You could go to your primary care physician. You could go to a Minute Clinic. You could go to a urgent care center. You can go, and as you said, there are lots of employers that are working. Because, of the flu season being more severe or anticipated to be more severe this year here in Hawaii than what it has been, there are a lot of employers that are doing that are collaborating with pharmacies to get their flu shot. And so that's something you could talk to your employer about and or your human resources person and say, look, you know, can we run a flu clinic in our department or in our business, in our place of business? It doesn't have to be a huge business in order to get the flu shot. At the association, we're a relatively small business, and yet we got one of our members, actually PharmaCare, to come in, and they organized to give all of us a flu shot. So again, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to have 50 or 100 people in order to run a flu clinic at your place of work. And that's a very convenient way where everyone can just sort of line up and go through and get the flu shot.
And it's not too late to organize one.
It is not too late to organize one, and it's not too late to get the flu shot. It's the flu actually is around all year. It's just its severity comes at this, you know, during the winter. So getting the flu shot, even if you haven't gotten the flu shot yet, getting the flu shot is still a good thing to do.
And then also at long-term care facilities, we had talked about how do you manage exposure for the folks, for the elderly folks that might be more susceptible to germs.
Well, what a lot of hospitals and long-term care facilities and other organizations are doing is they are encouraging and motivating all their staff to get the flu shot. So that's one of the first lines of prevention, is have all the staff get their flu shot. Some places are restricting access, for example. They're not letting kids in during visiting hours. They're just trying to minimize the amount of traffic that's coming in and out of their facilities during this time of the year. They're really focusing on best practices, frequent hand washing, isolating patients if they do have the flu. If you don't have a flu shot or haven't taken the flu shot or choose not to get the flu shot, you know, you could wear a mask if you're around people who do have the flu. So there's other things you can do, but the hospitals and the long-term care facilities are actively engaged in minimizing the impact of the flu.
Okay, so we'll be hearing more about it over the next several weeks. Thank you very much for joining us today in the studios.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
That was Hilton Rathel, the head of Hawaii's Healthcare Association, stressing the need for Hawaii to be on guard as we move into the peak flu season. Expect to hear more about the flu prevention campaign over the next month.
We admit it, we want to get closer to you.
There's so much happening at HPR these days. Great new programs, unique local coverage from our award-winning news team, and all sorts of ways we can work together to make life in our islands even better. We'd like to tell you more about HPR and would love to add you to our email list. Please sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you, and with your email, you'll be hearing more from us soon.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, training today's undergraduates for Peace Corps service. But first, your quiz.
In its 55-year history, the Peace Corps has sent over 1,300 Hawaii residents to remote places to build relationships and improve local communities. Last year, we interviewed then-director of the Peace Corps, Carrie Hessler-Radlett, during her visit to Hawaii. Hawaii's connection to the Peace Corps goes even deeper than that, though. From 1962 to 71, thousands of Peace Corps volunteers traveled to Hawaii for training. These particular volunteers had been assigned to countries in Southeast Asia and the Pacific, and Hawaii was selected as a training site due to its similar terrain and climate. But Hawaii is a diverse place with plenty of options for such training. So for today's backyard quiz, we want to know where in Hawaii the Peace Corps used to train its volunteers. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. And the first one to get it right gets our reusable HPR tote bag. Peace Corps is a Kennedy-era creation, emblematic of an idealistic chapter in American life, when young people answered the president's summons in his inaugural address to share American skills and know-how with the world's poorer nations. Ours is a very different world today, but the Peace Corps survives, and UH Manoa is inaugurating an undergraduate certificate program called Peace Corps Prep to pass along the skills that will be needed for service overseas. It's administered by the college's Spark M. Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution, whose director, Maya Sotoro Ng, spoke with us yesterday about its goals.
I think perhaps more than ever today, even more so than in the time of its creation, the Peace Corps has enormous potential for grassroots diplomacy, for community resilience, for development of collaborative relationships and deep understanding. And I think that it's more relevant than ever now because we understand that when we go to the Peace Corps and we take an assignment, that the learning comes both ways. There's less arrogance in the process. I think there is an openness to the valuable contributions of every culture, and there is an effort to use culturally relevant practices that are sourced locally and therefore have greater chance of longevity in terms of community development or education or health and wellness. And so I think that I'm excited about the direction of the Peace Corps. I'm excited that now the Peace Corps will allow mid-career level contributors who can take shorter stints if they can't sort of take, you know, a couple years off and go off. I think that now, by virtue of allowing people to select their region, we can pair people much more readily with the spaces that would be most benefited by their presence. And I think before going somewhere and not knowing where in advance and not necessarily having any of the linguistic skills or cultural knowledge was a wonderful way to be a sojourner and to learn and to have an adventure, but it was less useful for the world, I think. And so I like the new trajectory, in other words. And so we at the Matsunaga Institute for Peace were really interested in thinking about how to connect, collaborate, and support these current Peace Corps efforts.
Early iterations of the Peace Corps, when it first happened, capitalized on that Kennedy-era idealism, right? Ask what you can do for your country and all that. But it I think to many countries, it had a little bit of the whiff of colonialism in the sense that this was bringing European technology to the Third World. And you know, a little bit of a hint of this is our better way that we are bringing to you. Is that fair?
I believe it was fair. Now, that wasn't necessarily the stance or the attitude of Peace Corps volunteers who went very often. They came with humility and with powerful good intention. But overall, there was a underlying current, I believe, of sort of, in neocolonial kind
like
of
like a cultural colonialism.
Yeah, and certainly at the very least arrogance, as I said before. You know, I think that there is great value though in people stretching and leaning into their own discomfort and being reflective. And what has transpired since then is really the mandate that participants and volunteers do just that. And I think we've come a long way, and which is not to say that there wasn't immense value in those earlier iterations and generations, but I'm glad that the Peace Corps has been willing to kind of change some of its language and the tone and some of its training to adjust for contemporary needs and understandings and to try to be relevant in an ongoing way.
It's happening in the context of a very different population. There was a kind of in a way, coming out of the Second World War and the Marshall Plan, idealism among the young was pretty easy to foster, you know, self-sacrifice. And JFK in that first inaugural capitalized on that. It's just a very different mood among the young today.
I agree, although as a professor, as a teacher at the University of Hawaii, at Manoa, I'm seeing there a kind of resurgence of a desire for robust civic engagement, for participation, for movement building, for grassroots activism and activity. I think that they see now this generation that and at this time in particular that they can't afford to be lazy and that they need to be both informed and to choose to participate. I think the difficulty is that there is a lot of competition in terms of things to do online and that sort of thing. But there is so much opportunity in the fact that young people can blog and vlog and create videos and self-publish and raise their voices and connect and participate civically in ways that are unprecedented. And so I'm seeing the desire begin to blossom to meet the technological capacity to participate.
The skills that you're teaching in this program are described as the kind of skills that make you valuable to the Peace Corps. What are they?
Right. So the Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution has, other programs. We have a bachelor's in peace studies and a undergraduate certificate in peace studies and a graduate certificate in conflict resolution. This is a special program that looks specifically at those tools and skills and dispositions, as you mentioned, that would be valuable, and those are inclusive of cross-cultural understanding, second language acquisition, you know, action plan development. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is not only to go and learn, but to engage all of our talents and the resources that exist in a particular place, and to facilitate local action planning for sustainable development. And so many of those skills, and when you join the Peace Corps Prep program that we are facilitating, and I have to emphasize, this is, yes, a Manoa certificate and program, but it is actually administered by the Peace Corps. So they are setting, to a great extent, the scope and sequence. We have shown them what we have to offer on our campus, mm-hmm. and they have approved of that scope and sequence because it aligns with their standards. But they are actually the administrators of the certificate, and they're the ones who would send that certificate to the student. But they really mandate not just 50 hours of community service, but ongoing and creative engagement with the community. So they look a lot at leadership skills and leadership for social change as a class that I teach, for instance, mm-hmm. that would be part of the certificate. And so we're very excited to begin thinking about peace building through the lens of the Peace Corps as more action-oriented and more pragmatically designed to prepare people for service, not simply locally, but also internationally. The hope is that we build a sense of global kuleana with the firm belief that we need to be bridge builders and we need to have, in our globalized era, robust, meaningful relationships and collaborations with people all over the world.
It's often argued that the world into which your young students are entering is getting to be a pretty even more contentious one, that is moving away from a lot of the ideals you just described. Is that something, do your students express concern about that to you?
Certainly they do, although I find that being with them, I actually am granted an optimism that exceeds that which I feel in other spaces mm-hmm. of life and community. They are, I think, sometimes overwhelmed, again, just because of the flood of communication and ideas and opportunities, figuring out how to target their leadership and to reframe and build slowly their capacity to participate is something that we endeavor to do. But there has to be, and what we try to provide for them is an understanding of how we can incrementally build on the skills and opportunities, how we can act and engage and improve and be peace-building leaders in, you know, sometimes small ways, day-to-day. And we may not be able to solve, you know, ourselves the problem of, say, North Korea or, the Middle East, but what we can do is meaningfully contribute to the development of more resilient communities, improved relations and understanding, deeper compassion, and problem solving that actually improves the lives of individuals in a community.
So if you're looking for reasons for optimism, there actually are some out there.
There are. There really are. I often say drenched with gratitude to be able every day to work in alignment with my most cherished values. And a big part of that is that I believe that although this generation struggles sometimes again with not having a lot of the information, mm-hmm. background, historical context, because things can be overwhelming today. When it comes to things like inclusion, when it comes to things like fairness, when it comes to expression and, you know, human rights and civil rights and the desire for personal peace and understanding, they actually seem to be getting it right. As long as I've been there and as far as I've seen this generation coming up, while faced with a great many challenges and certainly sometimes while expressing an excessive amount of interest in perhaps, you know, popular culture that isn't particularly magnanimous or brave, for the most part, with regards to those fundamentals, they're on board. You know, they really are less selfish, I think, and stubborn in many ways than previous generations. So keep hope alive.
Maya Sotoro Ng is the director of the Spark M. Matsunaga Institute for Peace and Conflict Resolution. To learn more about it, click on our Facebook page for links to the program.
Support for today's programming comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. CMH's Trey Somble and guitarist Ian O'Sullivan celebrate Valentine's Day with Piazzolla's Music of the Tango, February 12th and 19th. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Civil Beat. Reporter Nathan Eagle has a story that looks at the latest wrinkle in dealing with sea level rise. Morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
So tell us about this legal opinion.
Well, it's complicated. It deals with everything from liability to responsibility. But essentially, it's saying that when erosion happens or sea level rises, the state land moves malka or landward as that happens, and so that becomes public. But then the property owners get charged, in essence, to pay for an easement to access their buildings and structures that, you know, they once owned but now are on state land.
That's kind of a head scratching. It seems like there are just so many properties along the shoreline that, you know, stand to be threatened. And this is just such an interesting way to deal with this problem.
It really is. Yeah. And we've essentially encouraged that kind of development for decades. So, you know, on the one hand, you talk to some attorneys who are defending these private property owners' rights, and they're saying, hey, like, you okayed these permits. We should have a fair return on our investment. And then you talk to attorneys and stuff on the other side who are saying, hey, you built on the coast. You know that the sea level is rising. You know erosion happens. So this is your problem. You deal with it. So it's really a huge dilemma.
Right, and I think DLNR just recently spotlighted this issue of sea level rise and the effects on properties statewide, really. And so going forward, you know, what happens? What kind of legislation do we have in the hopper at the Capitol?
And, you know, there's really not much. There is one piece of legislation that is a carryover from last year that would at least give the land board some flexibility in how much it charges for these easements. And that's something that's pushed. I'm not sure if it's going to go anywhere this year, but it's one that we'll be watching. But you're right, though. The DLNR has been trying to highlight the sea level rise that came out with a huge report, like 300-some pages, that, you know, saying, you know, even a conservative three-foot increase in ocean level over the next, you know, 70 years or so would be about $19 billion in damage.
Wow. And the fix to that is not going to be cheap at all.
It's really not, no. And part of it, too, I think needs to be just, you know, from talking to the various experts on this, some kind of consistency with seawalls. You know, the state has essentially said we're done with that, but the counties haven't caught up with that. And the seawalls, of course, the problem is that, yeah, they protect that property right behind it, but then they completely kind of wreck the beaches on either side.
Now, in your report, you also mentioned that this opinion is really just a legal opinion, that the courts haven't really decided on this.
That's correct. Yeah, it's just that. It's the opinion of the current Attorney General's office. You know, it carries some weight, but not the effect of law.
All right. Nathan, thank you. We will be keeping an eye on this for sure. That was Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check.
As we told you at the top of the show, Hawaii Emergency Management Agency Administrator Vern Miyagi has resigned within the hour, and our news director, Bill Dorman, was monitoring that news conference. And that's not the only story to emerge from this news conference, is it?
Chris and Catherine, this was just stunning. The governor's news conference, along with Major General Art Logan, the Director of Emergency Management, and Brigadier General Bruce Oliveira, who's the investigating officer who Governor Ige tasked with doing an initial report on what happened. And some of this is just extraordinary. As you said, Vern Miyagi is out as administrator. He resigned effective this morning. One employee has been terminated, the one who sent the alert. One employee has resigned. They're in the process of suspending one without pay. But just some extraordinary news about this employee who had sent the alert, that he had been, and I'm quoting from the report from General Oliveira, a source of concern for the same state warning point staff for over 10 years. Employee one's poor performance had been counseled, documented, and state warning point members have stated they are, quote, not comfortable with employee one as a supervisor, two-man team, or part of the state warning point in general. He does not take initiative, has to be directed before he takes action, unable to comprehend the situation at hand, and has confused real-life events and drills on at least two separate occasions.
I was kind of shocked when I saw that report and that section. It is. It's stunning.
And it goes on about employee one stating that he initiated the real-world civil danger warning, said that he did not hear the announcement exercise at the beginning and at the end of the simulated message, said that he did hear this is not a drill over the speaker. However, all state warning point members clearly heard exercise at the beginning and the end. And then this narrative goes on to just sort of paint a chilling picture of what happened. And they refer to people as employee numbers. Employee 5 directed employee 1, who's the person who sent out the false alert, to send out the cancel message. Employee 5 stated that employee 1 just sat there, didn't respond. Employee 3 returned to the state warning point from starting the time clock and saw employee 4 and employee 10 repeatedly get on the Hawaii warning system, letting the counties know it was just a drill. Employee 2 was on the phone with employee 6, briefing them on the situation. Employee 5 was alerting the command staff. Employee 1 was sitting and seemed confused. Employee 3 took control of employee 1's mouse and sent the cancel message. At no point did employee 1 assist in the process of correcting the false alert.
Where to begin, Bill? You know, one of the things that, in terms of its impact on the governor's office, we have to ask the question, what did they know and when did they know it? Because it's pretty clear from this report that a great deal more was known about what happened than we were told at the time. This has been 2 weeks now.
Well, and there's a detailed timeline that is part of this. Also, there's the FCC. Separately, the FCC had a report out this morning that came out morning Washington time saying that basically employee number one thought that this was a real event and, again, did not hear the phrase exercise. That's according to a written statement that the FCC got that was gathered by the state but that had not been released yet. So there are all kinds of questions that are going to follow from this. There's a very detailed timeline within General Oliveira's report. There is also, don't forget, another report coming. Brigadier General Ken Hara is still looking at a broader assessment of the emergency management alert system and reviews. General Oliveira's report is a starting point on that. Governor Ige, by the way, was asked at this news conference, are you going to drop out of the race because of this? And he said, I'm still running. But just an extraordinary hour or so in terms of that that news conference. A lot of new information coming up. Wayne Yoshioka is going to have a full report on this later today on All Things Considered. We'll be back, and we'll be talking about this for quite a while. But, again, just wanted to update our listeners with the very latest for now.
Bill, thanks a lot. It's clear this story is just not going away, is it?
Absolutely.
The State of the Union Address.
We must look not only at where we are and where we're going, but where we've been.
In the words of our founders, to form a more perfect union.
They've done so during periods of prosperity and tranquility. And they've done so in the midst of war.
Our resolve is firm and our union is strong.
It's President Trump's turn tonight. Live coverage from NPR News.
Starting at 4 p.m.
There aren't many places on Earth where you can stand on a snow-covered mountain and a sandy beach in the same day. Hawaii can be one of them. At around 13,800 feet above sea level, the summit of Mauna Kea is the highest point in Hawaii and often sees snow in the winter months. It's typically associated with astronomy or Hawaiian cultural practices, but our producer Ryan Finnerty recently went there for a less common activity, skiing. He picks it up from the slopes.
Okay, we just got to the summit area of Mauna Kea, just around 13,000 feet. There's a little bit less snow than we were hoping for. It kind of melted off since the big storm, but there's still plenty of slopes that have some. We're all feeling the altitude a little bit, but the snow looks good and there's nobody out here, so we're pretty excited for a fun day. Everyone's just getting their equipment ready, and we're going to head up for the first run, and hopefully it's not going to hurt too much.
I enlisted the help of a fellow snow enthusiast for this trip, an avid snowboarder.
I'm Chris Nash. I'm from Haleiwa. Pretty excited to try and find some snow up here on the mountain here. All right, now it looks pretty good. I'm excited to get up to the top, see if we can hike up a little bit, and then hopefully hit a few runs. Under no imagination did I ever thought I'd be seeing snow in Hawaii. I think it'd absolutely be worth it. Definitely going to be a hike, though.
Established ski resorts use chairlifts and gondolas to quickly move large crowds up the slopes with minimal effort. That is definitely not the case on Hawaii's high mountains. If you want to ride the pineapple patter, you better be prepared for a full day of hiking. A four-wheel drive vehicle can get you close, but the last several hundred feet will be up to you.
We're about halfway up, first climb. There's a lot of exposed rock. It's a little bit loose. Definitely have to be careful where you step or take a little bit of a slide, but it's a beautiful day. Great views of Haleakala, Kahala, Waimea, and the snow looks good. Almost there, huffing and puffing, but we're getting to the top of the first climb and see how the snow feels.
What would have been a difficult hike by itself was made all the more challenging by the thin air around Mauna Kea summit, where the effective oxygen level is about half of what it is at sea level. Chris Nash.
The hike up was definitely a challenge. Terrain's pretty challenging. It's kind of like moon rock up here, but definitely worth it. The views are incredible, and we're definitely going to have a great ride down. Seems like you can see all of Hawaii from here. It's beautiful up here.
We didn't arrive at the mountain until almost 3 weeks after the last major snowfall. That meant a lot of exposed rock and slick, icy snow.
I'm at the bottom of our first run. The snow is definitely challenging. It's really slippery. You can tell that it's been sitting in the sun for quite a while, kind of icy. Definitely not the easiest snow to ride on, but it's here, and you can't beat skiing in Hawaii.
Skis and snowboards are not exactly common household items around Hawaii, so local residents have to get a little more creative. I found one group using some equipment definitely not designed for snow.
My name is Kaimana Akias from Kauai. We just wanted to come up here before the snow is gone. I have seen it before, but this is the first time I've seen it in a long time. For me, I don't have a snowboard or anything, so all of us just get out our boogie boards and whatever we like equipment we have. Popped some tubes today, so it's all good.
Yeah, I noticed you got a Wave Storm surfboard in the back. What's going to go down with that?
Oh, we all went down already. Backsides are pretty bruised, so I'm hurting. but it's really fun. No one's here. Definitely worth the trip over. Yeah.
Locals weren't the only ones taking advantage of the short-lived snow. I also found several intrepid visitors who came to take in what for many of them may be a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
My name is Erin Thatcher, and I grew up in Kansas, and I am now a Californian. I am here on family vacation. We just decided to do an alternative Christmas. Instead of trying to meet up in one place and exchange gifts, we just decided to meet up in a cool place that was like a gift in itself.
And did you expect to see snow on your trip to Hawaii?
Well, I have a really good friend that grew up on the Big Island, and so that was something she told me. She was like, you must have the experience of standing in snow in the morning and standing on the beach at night. And so that was my first moment of, wait, there's snow in Hawaii? So it's pretty cool. I'm excited to get the full experience. 13,800 feet, I think, down to sea level. Why not?
Would you come back to Hawaii just to ride the pineapple powder?
It feels like a rite of passage. I think if I ever find myself back this way, it's going to be high on my priority list.
Even visitors from as far away as Europe had heard about the snow.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Switzerland.
I'm Patrick from Switzerland.
And were you expecting to see snow on your vacation to Hawaii?
We hoped it.
But we didn't expect it because now we have snow in Switzerland, so we didn't want to see any snow. We wanted to see ocean and tropical gardens, beaches, because in Switzerland we have right now lots of snow. I don't know, about 2 meters, 1 or 2 meters of snow.
Back in my group, fatigue had set in and enthusiasm had dwindled to a level just above that of our new Swiss friends. It's going to be our last run of the day. The sun's starting to go down and everybody's pretty tired. The elevation is starting to hit us pretty hard. I'm out of breath from crossing the road. Nobody else wants to get out of the truck. I'm going to see if I can convince them to do one more run. Skiing in Hawaii is definitely not for the faint of heart, but it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience if you can find a way to do it. From the slopes of Mauna Kea, I'm Ryan Finnerty for Hawaii Public Radio.
And that was quite the adventure. You can find photos and video of Mauna Kea's winter conditions on the Conversation Instagram page, The Conversation HPR. We'll also post them at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Swain from Stage Left Productions. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we're looking at the history of the Peace Corps in Hawaii. Hawaii has sent a lot of young men and women to the Corps, more than 1,300. When the Peace Corps was founded in 1961, America was just beginning its long involvement in the Vietnam War. Peace Corps volunteers would soon become a part of that effort, working with rural villages across South Vietnam. Before sending volunteers to Southeast Asia, the Peace Corps would send them to training here in Hawaii. Rugged terrain and similar climate were what led to the selection of Hawaii as a training base. In today's quiz, we asked you to tell us where in Hawaii that training took place. A documentary film released last year by the North Hawaii Education and Research Center highlighted the training. It shows trainees studying in Hilo, fording a river in Waipio Valley, climbing Mauna Kea, and living in thatch huts on the Hamakua coast.
And Catherine Steve O'Hara, chair of the Department of Indo-Pacific Languages at UH Manoa, was the first to get that answer right. He helped train those Peace Corps volunteers in Hilo, and a great many people called in, showing it's pretty still strong in Hawaii. Thanks to all of us, all who called in. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping to prepare students for the SBA exam with topical content and practice for the types of questions found on the test. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
We know it as Beijing or Peking Opera, but the term is a bit of a misnomer. The traditional Chinese theatrical form known as Shichu is all too rarely performed in the West and almost never seen with the level of preparation that the Asian theater program at UH is bringing to this show, Fights and Delights, Three Chinese Comedies, later this month. Elizabeth Wickman-Walczak is co-director of a show that draws on months of training in song, speech, dance, acting, and combat. And for all its exotic origins, the show celebrates the elements of theater that reach well beyond their culture of origin. Elizabeth is with us in our studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. Pleasure to be here.
It looks as if in putting this together, this show, you look for the elements that would have universal appeal.
Well, that's certainly true. This is the first time the Asian Theater Program has collaborated with the Theater for Young Audience Program in mm-hmm. our department. So we were looking for pieces that, for several short pieces instead of one long one, and pieces with comedy, with a lot of fun to appeal to families and children.
One of the nice things about young audiences is that you can reach them with things like pratfall, things that don't depend on languages.
Well, that's very true. There's a lot of training that's gone into these pratfalls, however, since they include comic combat, mm-hmm. Comic acrobatics. So we really think that this is enjoyable for anyone of any age.
Well, you know, pratfalls take skill, right?
Absolutely.
It's all about tumbling and jumping and mm-hmm. really very skills related to dance, yeah?
Yeah, and our pratfalls this time include those that use swords, that use a very large burning candle balanced on a head, all sorts of interesting, unexpected things.
This all gets into the thing that you get in theater of... It takes a lot of work to make something look natural.
It absolutely does. So many scores of hours for every little bit of time on stage. In this case, that's included an entire semester of intensive training with students in the production attending two regular classes, one in voice and one in movement, and then individual classes several times a week with their teacher, one-on-one training in both the acting and the musicianship.
You know, a lot of these skills, I would think, would translate into other areas of theater in the future for
the
students.
We certainly believe that ourselves. That's one of the basic premises of the training we offer students in the Asian Theater Program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you see, what would be an example that people might be able to identify that they had seen in the past but would take them close to what they're going to see?
Oh, previous productions?
Yeah, or just something you might have seen, you know, in the movies or whatever.
Well, in terms of our own productions, the one we have a Chinese theater, a Shichu, Chinese so-called opera, as you said, a production every 4 years. So the last one was Lady Mu and the Yang Family Generals, mm-hmm. and the one before that was the White Snake. But you know, actually, the combat martial arts that are featured in Kung Fu films and Jackie Chan films come from Shichu. Jackie Chan's original training was, in fact, in Shichu.
Didn't he go to school as a very young child to learn all these skills?
Absolutely. He certainly did. And so do the artist teachers who come here to train our students. They begin their training any place between age 8 and 10, and it goes on for a number of years before they perform professionally.
Well, you know, comedy is always, when people talk about comedy in theater, they always talk about how difficult it is to precisely gauge what
Indeed.
It's going to take to get a laugh.
Indeed.
Right?
And in our case, the physical comedy is one thing, but there's also verbal comedy, even a lot of puns. And so translating those puns means finding a parallel circumstance in the English language that's in the same realm of conversation and will get the same level of laugh, which is quite an exploratory adventure. We actually had a semester-long seminar in translation for performance last spring with, I think, about 12, 14 students working on these scripts and coming up as a class with the initial first draft translations that then got radically revised in the course of working with the teachers.
Translation is hard enough to just convey meaning without actually conveying
a joke and a pun even more difficult. You are always having to select which part of the meaning you can actually get into the second language.
Yeah. And in the case of a joke, you've got to be able to parse down to what makes that funny.
Yeah. And so much humor is, in fact, culturally related. So, again, you have to find a parallel circumstance sometimes.
Yeah. What kind of reactions do you get from students taking part in this effort?
Well, I think, you know, one of my great pleasures is years after students have participated in one of these training programs and productions, they write me or call me or we run into each other and they talk about how this was one of the most important things that happened in their education, how it changed their life, how special it was. I think very often that's retrospect that allows them to see this because it's very intensive training. Mm-hmm. So students are working extremely hard. They are, in most cases, challenged to a very great extent. Mm-hmm. And I am always impressed by how they kind of knuckle down to that challenge and really commit themselves to it.
And you don't always know what's good for you at the time. Right.
This is true. This is true.
Elizabeth,
for all of us.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth Wickman-Walczak is professor of theater and director of the Asian Theater Program at UH Manoa, co-director of Fights and Delights, three Chinese comedies. They'll be performed at Kennedy Theater Main Stage the weekends of February 16th and 23rd. The plays will be performed in English, and you can get details on the Conversations Facebook page.
Aloha, this is Elizabeth Jensen. I'm NPR's ombudswoman. If you want to listen back to a show, visit The Conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's it for today, and up tomorrow we'll sit down with the new executive director of ACLU Hawaii to talk about the group's new study on Hawaii bail practices and what's on the horizon.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or want a pass one, you can find them on The Conversation page, with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkoot.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.